May we please have appearances in State versus Jurekin?
Good afternoon, Your Honor. My name is Christopher Godin. I'm with the Office of the Public Defender, and I represent Oscar Hurricane Hurricane.
Great. And I'm going to ask you to speak a little louder when it comes time for argument.
Yes, Your Honor.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Farron Anello from the ACLU of New Jersey on behalf of the National Association of Judiciary Interpreters and Translators and the American Translators Association.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Norma Esquivel on behalf of Amicus Latino Justice.
And good afternoon, Your Honors. Assistant Prosecutor Stephanie Davis-Elson from the Hudson County Prosecutor's Office on behalf of the state.
Welcome to all counsel. Mr. Goodman.
Thank you, Your Honors. And may it please the court, I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal if necessary.
That's fine.
Oscar Hurricane Hurricane has been in custody since the date of his arrest on June 4th, 2019. A lot has happened over the last 4 years. During that time, Mr. Hurricane Hurricane has attended dozens of court dates, first in person, then virtual, and again in person now. His interpreter, the Ketchikan interpreter, has only ever appeared remotely. Working with a remote interpreter was not easy. Hearings could not begin until 11 a.m. because the interpreter resided on the West Coast. Disruptions were frequent, whether for technical or other reasons. Private conversations, no matter how brief, required the creation of a breakout room on Zoom. As a result, the litigation of the Miranda motion in this case took well over a calendar year and generated nearly 1,000 pages of transcript. Despite this, we did not object to remote interpretation for pretrial hearings. The Ketchikan interpreter himself did not object to appearing remotely for pretrial hearings. It wasn't ideal. Everything took a lot longer than it might have otherwise, but we made do. That will not be possible when we have a jury impaneled. Jurors hate interruptions. They hate delays. If they believe that one of the parties is wasting their time, you can see it in their faces. You can see them wince when there's an objection. You can see them roll their eyes, exchange glances with one another. You can see them turn on you. There is not a jury instruction strong enough to protect Mr. Hurricane Hurricane from the entirely reasonable frustration that jurors will feel if they are forced to sit through a first-degree trial with remote interpretation. There is a reason why, for the first time in 4 years, we are objecting to remote interpretation. There is a reason why, for the first time in 4 years, the Ketchikan interpreter himself objected to appearing remotely. And there is a reason why the largest interpreter organizations in the country are joining us in making that objection. Remote interpretation for a criminal jury trial is not workable. Problems are inevitable, and the only person who will be prejudiced by those inevitable problems is Mr. Hurricane Hurricane. The trial court and appellate division orders violate fundamental notions of fairness and due process, and we are asking that this court reverse them as a result. Thank you, and that concludes my preliminary statement. I would like to discuss the three issues that I raised in my brief in the order that I raised them. First, I'd like to discuss the practical difficulties that remote interpreting will impose. Second, I would like to discuss how those difficulties will prejudice Mr. Hurricane Hurricane at trial. And third, I would like to present to this court the option of avoiding all of the constitutional questions raised by this case by interpreting Section 1.8 of the Language Access Plan to exclude criminal jury trials.
Would you mind if we started with a question that touches on your third point?
Absolutely.
Is your position, in a nutshell, that remote interpreting can never happen in a criminal trial?
My position at this time is that with the current technology and our current ability and the current state of how interpreting is performed, that no, there are never circumstances where a criminal jury trial would be fundamentally fair with remote interpreting.
Are there no safeguards that could be built into the process that might allow for remote interpreting?
I think that the problem, Your Honor, is that the chief safeguards that we could try to enact would be things like, well, we can take a break if there's a technical issue. We'll give the interpreter more breaks. All of these things, though, are in tension with what every trial attorney knows, which is that the more breaks you take and the more delays there are and the more interruptions there are, the more you lose the jury.
And with dual sets of interpreters, this case is going to be complicated, whether it's all in person or partly remote. That's unavoidable.
I agree with that, yes.
So with that in mind, are there measures that can be taken to ensure a fair trial? Are there safeguards that could be applied?
I am hard-pressed to think of any, Your Honor, if only because, again, the only safeguards that I could think of are going to increase the magnitude of the complications and are going to increase the magnitude of the prejudice against Mr. Huracan. It just is not a remedy to say that if there's a technical issue, we can take a break, because everybody in the room, including the jurors, is going to know why we need the break. This isn't a situation where we can really shield Mr. Huracan from these inevitable technical difficulties. That's the main problem that I have.
I think it would be a given that all of the jurors will understand this is a procedure, again, remote or in person, that requires multiple layers of interpretation, multiple interpreters. That's going to be obvious. So there's no hiding that from the jury. Would building in a consistent break every hour on the hour, hypothetically, to allow consultation to counsel, help preserve a defendant's fair trial rights?
Certainly it would help, Your Honor, but I don't think that it would solve the problem. And that really is fundamentally the argument that we are making here, which is that we can try our best to fix the problems that are inherent in remote interpretation, but that there are some that just are simply not fixable. And I would agree that there are issues whenever you have a case that requires an interpreter. All of those issues are magnified when one of those interpreters is remote. And that's something really that we're trying to avoid here with Mr. Huracan. And forgive me.
No, please finish your thought.
I only bring this up to say that I believe this is something that the ACLU, representing the interpreter organizations, talks about in their brief, and they may be able to discuss more. But I know when we say that we're going to have to take a break once an hour, it's actually my understanding, at least from their brief, that it's really closer to once every 15 minutes or so that they would need to give the interpreter a break. It is much more disruptive than that.
I was talking about speaking with counsel, and my next question goes to the opportunity to speak with the interpreter and give the interpreter a break. Would building in those sorts of breaks assist in ensuring a fair trial?
I think it would be necessary to even try to get close to it, but I don't know that it would get us to a fair trial. And if I could actually just say one thing, too, with respect to the—I didn't realize that Your Honor's question was about building in breaks to be able to speak with counsel. I'm sorry. I must have misheard. The only concern I have with that is that, really, there are things that happen in a jury trial that you either react to it in the moment or you don't. And so you can try to build in these, you know, once an hour, we can have a five-minute break to communicate with each other. But if in between those two times something comes up that we would have wanted to discuss and the client doesn't stop and ask for clarification in the moment, or the attorney doesn't want to disrupt everything yet again because they don't want to risk losing the jury and alienating the jury, then what happens in that moment is that the question just doesn't get asked.
And every time the defendant would need to consult with his attorney during these spontaneous points in trial when something comes up and a question he wants to ask or discuss, you would have to go to a breakout room.
At the very least, I will say that we hadn't yet received full guidance on exactly how this would work at the trial in this matter, but I do know that at least in previous instances, at one point, it's involved actually having the defense attorney call in on their personal cell phone and get added to the Zoom room, and then having to be in a different room from the defendant because there could be feedback issues. I know that they've also gone and taken both the defendant and the defense attorney into our jury room to try to have private communications. I think that was able to also avoid the feedback issue. But again, when we have a jury impaneled, we really can't do that because the jury room is where the jurors go. So, yes,
what about
enormously disruptive, as opposed to the current state of affairs, which is if I want to speak to my client at counsel table, I don't even have to ask the judge to go off the record. There's a little button I press, I whisper the question into the interpreter's ear, and I get the answer back. It's not disruptive at all, at least in comparison to what would have to happen if the interpreter was virtual. And I apologize, I know.
But I'll follow up off of that. Even in this case, that would be disruptive if everybody were in court, because you'd have to have, you know, push the button, talk to interpreter one. Interpreter one would have to translate for interpreter two, who would then talk to the judge. This will not be easy. And without complications, regardless of how it's conducted.
I agree with that. And I agree that to a certain extent, All of these problems exist whenever you have an interpreter that's involved in a trial. Whenever you have a client or a witness that is not an English-speaking person, it creates these complications. What I'm concerned about are compounding those already existing complications. This is something that, you know, I know the state says this at one point in its brief. We are not asking for a perfect trial. We know that it's not possible to get a perfect trial. The best interpreters in the world operating under ideal circumstances, like the best attorneys in the world operating under ideal circumstances, make mistakes. We're just trying to prevent those mistakes from harming, or at least try to minimize those mistakes to the extent that we are capable of. And again, in this case, we have an interpreter that is both not only ready, willing, and able to come here, but is, I mean, I think it comes through from the trial court record, profoundly uncomfortable with appearing virtually.
Would two sets of interpreters, possibly on both ends, assist in this regard?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
You may need, because of the strain on the interpreter, remote or in person, you may need double interpreters to allow for breaks during the course of the proceedings. Would that assist?
So what I will say is that is actually, especially with simultaneous interpreting, that's the best practice. So when we have, for example, Spanish-speaking clients who are on trial, all of the trials have multiple interpreters. They work in teams of at least two. They're constantly switching off with one another so that they don't interrupt the proceedings. My understanding is that in this case, they were only able to retain one Cachiquel interpreter, so that would be a limiting factor here. The second interpreter would not be, I think, an option, or at least that wasn't on the table as something that the trial court was going to be doing. But I apologize. Did I answer your question?
You have. One more question, then I'll yield to my colleague. Can cost be considered? And if so, how?
So I have a couple of answers to that. The first is I really don't think that it ought to be. When we are talking about an individual who has, you know, just the number of constitutional rights that are at stake that a criminal defendant does, we're talking about an individual who is looking at decades in state prison, if not life in state prison, depending on the charges. I don't think that it would be appropriate to have to subject that to some sort of a cost analysis, number one. And the other thing that I'll say is that really, you know, this isn't spoken about explicitly on the record, but the bulk of the cost of the interpreter is going to be his hourly rate. I mean, what we're really talking about here is saving money on airfare, lodgings, maybe a meal per diem, Your Honor. So it's really not even apparent that we're saving all that much money by having him be remote. And just the third point that I would like to make is that, and this is something that kind of comes up a lot in this, but there is a bit of an element of sort of measure twice, cut once here, right? If we can ensure that the interpretation is as good as it can possibly be, is when we have this trial the first time, we will not need to spend resources analyzing this on the back end. I mean, you could imagine what a nightmare this will be if we wanted to challenge some aspect of the interpreter, and we would need to have then the English that was spoken, the Spanish, and the Cachiquel. We would need to be able to have somebody analyze it that could look at all three of them and cross-reference
them. That's going to happen if you have a substantive issue about what an evidentiary ruling or some aspect of the questioning, that there's going to be the need to employ this interpreter again. I mean, it's not simply avoiding the issue of the interpreter himself is not going to avoid the need for the interpreter's services if there's a conviction and an appeal.
When I say this, I guess what I mean to say is actually having to sort of pop the hood and really look at every single sentence that was spoken and see if the translations were accurate and see if there were issues, and then trying to sort of divine from that what harms may or may not have come as a result of those.
Presumably you would look at that carefully, whether or not the interpreter is remote. You'd be looking to see if this was an accurate translation.
My understanding is that in many instances there isn't even necessarily a record kept of, you know, especially when it's consecutive interpreting, when a non-English speaker is testifying, then there's a record of it because you hear what is spoken fully in the foreign language and then you hear what the interpreter actually says. So there can be a record of that, but when there's simultaneous interpreting, my understanding is that there really isn't even always a record of that. I mean, here, if they were virtual, in theory, you could record all of the channels, so you could record everything that the Spanish to Ketchikan interpreter says, and then you could record everything that the English to Spanish interpreter says. So you could keep a record of that. But now we are talking about, I mean, again, when I get back to sort of measure twice, cut once here, that would be enormously expensive and enormously time-consuming, not only for my office's appellate unit to handle, but for appellate courts to be able to parse. I mean, you're...
But if I'm hearing you correctly, and you're doing this in a very genteel, very professional manner, what you've said is cost should never be considered, and that there are no factors, no guardrails that could ensure a fair trial. So you're asking for a per se rule.
I am asking for a per se rule, and I know that that sounds strong, but the only thing that I will say is that the per se rule that I am requesting here is not a new one. This is...
Is there case law in remote interpreting?
So the, I guess what I'm referring to is the previous Section 1.8, which since 2017 has said you can only have remote interpretation, or that in that pre-amendment section they said it could only be telephonic interpretation for emergent matters, right? That was a codification of pre-existing AOC directives that said the exact same thing, which is to say that this is the rule that I am requesting in this case has been the rule in this state for decades. That's the status quo.
We had not ever considered having millions of remote proceedings for court, and someone would have looked at us askance 4 years ago as to that as well. So,
absolutely.
Is there any law with respect to this that you're aware of?
I am not aware of any. This isn't something that really has been litigated very often. I really tried to scrape the bottom of the barrel on Lexis to find something, and I wasn't able to, and I'm really not aware of anyone.
Because prior to the pandemic and the millions of remote proceedings, I don't think there was much consideration for having remote translation during jury trials.
It's just not something that happened.
Didn't happen. Many of these remote proceedings didn't happen. So this is just one of them that didn't happen at all or wasn't even considered.
Yes.
Because that was not part of the judiciary's protocol, the policy at all.
All of the case law is really just about whether the person gets an interpreter. But I think there was the assumption that the interpreter would be in person. And I know you had a question. I apologize.
Obviously, there are very few people qualified to do this interpretation. This particular individual indicates, or at least implicitly indicates, that he would be willing to come to New Jersey for a trial. What happens if there is another language with very few people who are speakers of that language worldwide and a very small number of qualified interpreters, and shockingly, no one wants to spend July in New Jersey? Does that mean that the individual's charges have to be dismissed?
It does not, Your Honor.
So what happens?
If I could gently, before answering that question, just push back against one premise of it, which is that interpreters as a group of people are used to traveling. I had the opportunity to meet with a couple of interpreters while I was trying to write my brief. Half the time they were in Europe or on the West Coast. I mean, this is a group of people that understands that their job requires them to travel.
I'm sure they are. But there may be situations where there are so few interpreters and flying from the West Coast to the East Coast is simply not happening. So what happens? This is you want a per se rule, you want an absolute rule. This is the kind of difficulty that arises if there is an absolute rule.
I understand that, Your Honor. I will point to the Pennsylvania statute that I did cite in my brief, which does say that, you know, that approach is to say that if they're unable to find an interpreter that can come in person, that then you can, under certain circumstances, have a remote interpreter. I am not necessarily objecting to that. The only real concern that I have is that it's really to say that, you know, you're not able to find somebody to come in person. It's not that much more further of a jump to say that, well, financially, we can't find someone to come here, and then we're sort of right back where we are right now. And so that's my real concern. And again, I said this before, but I think that if this were a real serious problem that were going to happen frequently, we would have seen it before now. I mean, again, the rule in our state for decades has been, if it's a jury trial and there's an interpreter, the interpreter is in person, no exceptions. All we are asking is that this court to preserve the status quo that has existed here for years for a very, very, very narrow subset of cases. I mean, the actual percentage of my clients that that take their cases to trial, I don't have to tell everybody here, is vanishingly small. And so what we are just asking for is that in that circumstance, when all of the constitutional rights that ordinarily are waived or relaxed in pretrial hearings or when someone pleads guilty, all of those constitutional rights suddenly finally kick in for that tiny percentage of people that decide that they want to maintain their innocence and that they want to go to trial, we are just asking that this court maintain the status quo that has existed for years in this state. And I believe Your Honor had had a question earlier.
It was the same as Justice Patterson. It was just asking how much does it depend on the person being ready, willing, and able. But I understood you to say that it does depend on the person being ready, willing, and able. And if there's only an interpreter, for example, in another country, and the person cannot get to the United States, then your per se rule allows a jury trial to go forward with remote interpretation.
If there were some idiosyncratic case where you had an interpreter that was a resident of Guatemala and just literally could not get a visa for one reason or another, then I would think that, yes, I would be willing to envision a rule that relaxed that. But I would really want for there to be a strong, strong presumption in favor of in-person interpretation, because once we open that door even a little bit, my concern is just that, again, the judges that implement it will be able to use remote interpretation whenever they want, and it's just going to be difficult, if not impossible, on appeal for you to really prove that an individual was prejudiced because of their interpretation, just because especially of how difficult it would be, number one, to review all of that, and number two, a lot of the harms that we're talking about here are, whether or not a defendant chooses to testify, and I'm skipping a little bit ahead here, we talk about...
You're not suggesting, by the way, that there's not already a strong presumption of in-person interpreting based on how trials are conducted day in, day out in our state. Would that be fair?
That is correct, Judge. I mean, I'm not aware of a jury trial that has ever gone with a remote interpreter, at least in a criminal case. But again, this is all relatively new because this is something that before last September, before the language access plan was amended to increase the circumstances where remote interpretation can happen, it's just not something that was ever even considered.
I have a slippery slope concern. And you have confined your request for relief here to a criminal jury trial, which is the procedural posture we're in this case right now. But what principled reason would there be in the next case that would preclude a defendant from saying a pretrial detention hearing is a very critical moment where I need be able to communicate effectively with my client. My client may want to speak at the proceeding. I mean, what would be a principled basis to have other important pretrial proceedings, particularly those that would involve testimony, like in a suppression hearing also, where the same kind of argument would be made by a different attorney saying, following the principle that was established in this case, me too. I think it's just not as good. It's not adequate given the serious stakes that are also involved in that criminal proceeding.
What I will say is I think there are really two principal distinctions. The first one is just the presence of a jury. Courtrooms are different places when you have a jury involved. Judges and court administrators are acutely aware of the fact that you have 12, 14, 16 members of the general public that are volunteering their time. They are not being paid. They do not like to waste those jurors' time. Additionally, unlike with judges, if some sort of prejudicial testimony comes out in front of a jury, you can't always rely on them to disregard that testimony. You can certainly ask for it, but they're, one of the primary reasons that defense attorneys move for mistrials is because information came in that the jury heard that they don't think they're going to be able to get them to unring that bell. So that's really the first principal distinction. And the second one, I think, and this is really more of, I guess, a general one, which is that we draw this line all the time, right? I mean, the rules of evidence are, with the exception of Miranda motions, relaxed at suppression hearings because we have an understanding that the due process rights that someone is afforded at a suppression hearing are relaxed. All of the procedural safeguards that we have are the strongest during a jury trial. And we do that because that is what we have decided is the event that requires us to be the most careful about, you know, trying to protect the criminal defendant's rights. So I guess, you know, I would say that the same principle that says that leading questions and hearsay and, you know, otherwise inadmissible evidence are fine in front of a grand jury presentation are not fine at a jury trial would also say that, you know, remote interpretation is fine at a grand jury presentation would not fine at a jury trial. The same principle that lets us say prosecutors can proceed by proffer at a detention hearing, but they can't proceed by proffer at a jury trial would also say that we can have remote interpretation at a detention hearing, but not at a jury trial.
How about a plea? Where again, we're anticipating the defendant's going to be speaking under oath. That's not so vital that we wouldn't require it there for the, based on the same logic.
What I will say is that that is a moment that is not subject to the logistical constraints that a jury trial is.
Sure.
That is something that all of the parties have a lot more time to prepare for. You can have a very long conversation with your client about what that's going to look like. It can take as long as it needs, because at the end of the day, all we need to make sure is that he understands what's happening and that he's waiving his rights voluntarily and that he is, in fact, admitting to whatever it is that he is pleading guilty. So,
and as you said in your opening statement, the complex nature of the jury trial is the reason why, for the first time throughout the duration of this particular case, you are asking for in-person interpretation services. The nature of pretrial hearings is significantly different from the nature of a jury trial, where the interpretation during a pretrial hearing, just like the interpretation during this proceeding, does not involve multiple people speaking at different times, multiple things taking place in a courtroom simultaneously in the same manner that a jury trial proceeds. So the complex nature of a trial is very different from a plea hearing or any pretrial motions, where it's normally the case one person is speaking, they speak for a long period of time, then another person speaks, I mean, subject to any objections, but that's not the same as kind of the fast-moving pace of a jury trial where there's multiple discussions taking place and multiple things happening at once.
Absolutely. I agree with that, Your Honor.
And I did want to go back to the policy. So I know you're asking for a bright line rule. However, the policy gives the judges discretion to make the determination as to whether the remote interpreting should be used. If we don't go with your bright line rule, can we just look at the facts of this case and make a determination that, you know, in this particular case, remote interpreting was not appropriate given the complex nature of the two levels of interpreting, the fact that the interpreter himself said that he did not believe this was something that he could do and do well, that he had never done this before. He had never provided interpreting services virtually for a jury trial, and he had concerns, and that those concerns were not really addressed by the trial court, at least in the transcript of that one proceeding that we have. Can we look at the facts of this case and make a determination that in these particular circumstances, which may be unique, might not be unique, I mean, I don't know how many cases there are with multiple levels of interpretation and an interpreter who says on the record, I am not comfortable with doing this, but can we look at the facts of this case and make a determination just based on this case?
I definitely think that if this court is going to design some sort of a balancing test, that a remand is not necessary. I think that this court, depending on the test that it devises, can certainly look at this and say that it was not appropriate. I don't think that we need to remand it for any more fact-finding, because I'm not sure that it would really reveal anything that would be determinative of the outcome. So, yes, I
just try to keep your voice down.
Yes, here. I apologize.
I know. We're the closest. You're the closest to me, but I think everyone else can
hear Judge 17.
Not a lot of people want to do that.
And then the only thing I will say, and I think this is something that a couple of the justices have gotten at, you know, if we are going to have some sort of a balancing test, I really would, you know, I use the word idiosyncratic sort of intentionally. I think that if we have a case where there is an idiosyncratic situation with an interpreter that can't get a visa to come to the United States, or if there is, you know, some other sort of a unforeseeable circumstance like that, then we could possibly overcome that presumption. But I would certainly ask that if we were going to be doing that, that, then I would want to know specifically what the cost difference is. Because again, I am suspicious that we're even really saving all that much money by having this interpreter do this remotely rather than in person. My understanding of this is that their hourly rate's going to be the most important thing. Additionally, I think that the degree of the charges is something that I think should be taken into account. I think that to the extent that we're going to be balancing costs, we should also then at least take into account the fact that somebody charged with something more serious has more at stake, and therefore there should be more of a tendency to reward that person with in-person interpretation.
You brought up the modest cost twice. I'm just going to suggest to you that you not volunteer Mr. Krikora to fund this.
I would never, Your Honor. The only other thing, not the only other thing, I would also say, though, that I think in whatever test is developed, I think deference to the interpreter should be required. I don't see why the interpreter isn't the best person in the room to be able to actually tell us whether or not they think that this is going to work.
Deference to an interpreter on a court management issue that, in which the interpreter may, and I'm not saying this in any nefarious way, but an interpreter may have an interest in maximizing the number of hours spent. Because this is that person's livelihood. So I suggest we would defer to an interpreter, certainly welcome the information they provide, but to make them the fact finder of sorts is what you're suggesting. Wouldn't that be rather strange?
The only thing that I will note is that interpreters have a code of ethics. They, especially interpreters that are operating in our state, are required to follow ethical guidelines. So that
As do expert witnesses in many fields, but I doubt very much there are any courts that are saying that we'll defer to the expert on the conditions and under which that expert's going to testify in court.
I understand Your Honor's position. I would just say that I think that if the interpreter had said I am comfortable doing this, I think that I can do an adequate job, and it's something I've done before. I have a lot of experience with. I do think that we would be in a different position, forgive me, Your Honor, than we are in right now, where the interpreter is saying I am profoundly uncomfortable with this. I've never done it before, so I don't know that it should necessarily be dispositive, but I do think it's something that we should be giving weight to. Additionally, I think that if we are going to have the possibility of remote interpretation, then we are going to need to have additional safeguards at the trial, with at the very least find some way of completely preserving all of the interpretation, even for the circumstances where that interpretation is simultaneous, where there's not always a record of it preserved now. I think we're going to need to have...
Wouldn't a video record be adequate for that?
For that, yes. But my understanding is that that's not necessarily something that would be happening. I don't know that that was going to happen at this trial. But I think that that would be, and when I say adequate, I mean that's like a bare bones sort of, at the very least, if we're going to be doing this, then we need to make it so that someone at some future point can go back and review it and make sure that there weren't any mistakes.
Just as a practical matter, what happens in a criminal trial where there's some concerns about the quality of the interpretation that's going on? Assuming it's a live interpretation, do courts approve some sort of a sound record or video record to preserve the potential objection to the adequacy of the interpretation?
So I think that it depends. I think that if it is consecutive interpretation, so if you have a non-English speaker testifying, then it is preserved as a part of the record. I am not aware of what happens under circumstances where we would be objecting to the quality of the interpretation for the simultaneous interpretation that is the majority of it. What I will say is that this is something that we, at least I know in Hudson County, are fortunate enough not to have a problem with. Our interpreters that we interact with, especially the staff court interpreters, are good at their jobs. They are competent. We don't have an issue with them.
I'm not certain what you're asking for in this respect, then. Please explain.
Forgive me.
What type of recordation are you asking be preserved?
That if we're going to have this remote interpretation, that the simultaneous interpretation that happens that is not always recorded, that it does be recorded.
But the simultaneous recording from the interpreter sitting next to someone who does not speak English and is on trial is not currently being recorded.
It's being recorded, but only because it's consecutive. So the the witness speaks in the foreign language in front of a microphone that is
not
recording on CourtSmart.
The witness is speaking English in my question
so
to you.
In that hypothetical, then no, my understanding is it's not being recorded. It's because if the witness is speaking in English, then there's no need for consecutive interpretation. It's simultaneous. And at that point, then the interpreter is either whispering in the client's ear as the witness goes, or the interpreter is speaking on a headset that uses the same radio technology that a walkie-talkie does.
So that's the point that I was attempting to make. There's no recordation being made of the in-court interpreting, but you're asking that if it's out of court, that it be preserved? What's the distinction that you're drawing?
The distinction is that when interpreters are doing their job remotely, when they are doing their job over video, they make more mistakes. And so I would need there to be a record of the actual interpretation that they are doing so that we can go back and at least check and see if they made mistakes. Right now, we presume that they're doing their job correctly, and frankly, it's not an issue that we have to deal with because our staff interpreters are very good. But if we are going to be introducing this new source of error into a jury trial, then I think we're going to need to, at the very least, record even when the interpreters are doing simultaneous interpreting. I just want to briefly touch on one or two things from the first part of my brief, which is that, and this is something that I know the ACLU attorney who is representing the interpreters' organizations can maybe touch more on, but if there's one point that I would like to make and that I would hope that people come away from with this is that interpreting is difficult. All of the literature that I have read on this use some version of the phrase cognitive load. They say that interpreters carry a high cognitive load, or they use a large portion of their working memory or short-term memory. All of these phrases get at the same basic idea, which is that interpreters, particularly when they're doing simultaneous interpreting, are more or less operating at capacity. They are operating at the outer limits of what the human brain is able to do, and it's the reason why they have to spend, at least if they're following best practices, as much time resting as they spend interpreting. It's not because they're lazy or because they have a very good union. It's because they physically cannot do this for longer than 30 minutes at a time without beginning to make so many mistakes that it becomes unacceptable.
So does that mean with one interpreter, which it appears may be the best that can be done, there would have to be a break, whether the person was live or remote, every 30 minutes to give the interpreter arrest?
At the outside. I believe that it can be less than that depending on the circumstances, but yes, my read or my understanding is that about every 30 minutes or so at the very least they would need to take a break. That's the reason why when we have Spanish interpreting, which is most of the interpreting that we do in our courthouse is Spanish to English and English to Spanish, whenever we have interpreters, they relieve each other. So once we get an interpreter in our courtroom, if it's a testimonial motion and it goes for long enough, you'll see they'll pause everything for 5 seconds, they'll come in, they'll switch out headsets, and then they'll keep going with the new interpreter. So that is something that is a standard practice in their profession, and I'm certain is something that my colleague could address more during their argument as well.
So we have your very fine brief, so for the remaining points that you'd like to convey, please try to do so in a more clipped fashion.
Yes, Your Honor, forgive me. The only thing that I do want to say, and something that I really did want to emphasize here, is that even fleeting problems with interpretation can be prejudicial. There's a reason why I cited the California case, People v. Aguilar, 35 Cal 3rd, 785. You know, to the extent that a defendant is going to decide whether or not to testify, right? They have an absolute constitutional right to testify or not testify. To the extent that they're going to decide to do that, they're doing it in part on the sum total of all of the evidence that has come in at the trial up until that point. So to the extent that they have maybe failed to misunderstand certain portions of it along the way, any amount of failure to fully understand what has happened prior to that could affect their decision to testify. And I think most importantly, would be almost impossible to prove prejudicial on appeal. Right, there's rarely a one-to-one relationship between why a defendant chooses to do something or not do something, or chooses to testify about something or not, and a specific interpreting error. These are all things that sort of depend on the sum total of all of the evidence that's on the record. Let me see. I do want to say also, this is something that I mentioned in my brief, but I will be very quick with it. I cannot emphasize enough how often new testimony comes out at trial that is nowhere in any of the discovery that has ever been provided to us. In every single criminal trial that I have ever seen, witnesses testify about things that they told nobody about prior to taking the stand. We don't have the benefit of deposition testimony. And in that moment, especially with the time constraints of a criminal jury trial, I can't go do an investigation request. In that moment, the only person that I have that can help me try to, you know, craft my cross-examination is my client. And so to the extent that we're putting a burden on those communications, those necessary communications, we are also burdening my ability to perform on his behalf. With respect to the third point, the constitutional avoidance point, I would just reiterate that, again, this is a very narrow set of circumstances that we are asking to preserve the status quo for. We can still see situations where remote interpretation would be appropriate for pretrial motions and status conferences, for family court cases, for civil cases, including small claims, landlord-tenant, municipal court cases. I mean, I cannot emphasize enough what a small subset of cases we are asking for in-person interpretation for in this particular case. And I guess I will conclude reserving any remaining time for rebuttal by just saying, you know, when you read the language access plan, I think that, you know, there's a lot of powerful language in there. And I think that it's, especially when you read the introduction of the language access plan, you come away with...
Council, we've got your point. We're at 40 minutes, and I want to make sure that we get the day done soon enough. So if you
thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Ms. Anello.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm here today on behalf of the National Association of Judiciary Interpreters and Translators and the American Translators Association. It is exceptionally rare for NAGIT and ATA to file amicus briefs. NAGIT, I think, has done so once over 10 years ago, and ATA, I was not able to find any record of a prior amicus. But they've done so in this case because the issue presented is critically important to their members' ability to meet their professional standards and to the rights of defendants in criminal trials. Remote interpreting in a criminal trial would undermine the interpreter's accuracy and completeness. As shown in the literature we discussed in our brief, create serious ethical risks for interpreters and ultimately may impair New Jersey courts' ability to recruit interpreters for criminal trials. As the Second Circuit held in Negron, interpretation has to be sufficient to allow a non-English-speaking defendant to participate effectively in his own defense. And it's imperative that every criminal defendant, if their right to be present means anything, to possess sufficient present ability to consult with their lawyer with a reasonable degree of rational understanding. So starting with that, I just wanted to pause briefly to respond to a question that came up about taking breaks and cognitive load. And then I'll get to my other points, but.
May I ask you up front?
Yes,
are you advocating a per se rule as well?
Yes, Your Honor. We are advocating a per se rule.
Please go ahead.
And this is because to step back, actually, a moment, just to answer that question. The literature on remote interpreting is still being developed. The studies have looked at remote interpreting in contexts such as conference settings, which are very different than criminal trials, less need for immediate decision-making, no jury, less complicated in terms of the demands, the other demands on the interpreter, and in police, simulated police interviews. But there is no experimental studies that I've been able to find looking at criminal trials. There are some observational studies and looking at different court practices around Europe. But the fact is that if New Jersey was to adopt a rule permitting remote interpreting in criminal trials, we would be conducting a large-scale experiment. And one which the literature suggests there is significant reason to think would impair the rights of defendants.
Why would this be a large-scale experiment? There's no proposal in this case that when we have, of course, not only court interpreters for several languages, but also qualified interpreters for other languages in New Jersey, it's live. So to suggest that at issue in this case is some sort of large-scale conversion of live interpretation to remote interpretation, I respectfully don't think this is what the case is about.
Justice, that is an important point you raised, which is that this does affect a relatively small number of cases, which I think is something that's important to consider when we think about the costs of in-person interpreting in those cases. And also, as I think my colleague here will probably address more later, you know, address it burdens a group that's already the most marginalized group of defendants because they speak languages that are so rare, my clients would call them languages of lesser diffusion, that there are no interpreters in the New Jersey area.
We're dealing with a very small number of cases. Your colleague has said that. So in terms of in terms of affecting, for example, New Jersey's ability to attract qualified interpreters, I just respectfully don't know how that could be when your colleague is telling us this is an extraordinarily rare circumstance.
Justice, I think the concern is about attracting interpreters for those trials in which there might be remote interpreting.
Yeah, and that's a very small scale issue.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's true, and I think the issue here is really about, when I say an experiment, I guess maybe large scale was the wrong term, but I think the concern is that, as Mr. Gordon explained before, the kinds of challenges that are raised by remote interpreting, things like increased error rates, increased fatigue, sense of alienation from the proceedings, impaired visual access, distractions, you know, in a criminal trial setting, for example, the interpreter would be having to monitor four or five channels of communication to communicate with court staff, with counsel for the defendant, with the interpreting partners, in ways that are much easier if you're sitting in the room with people and require text-based communication if you're not. And I'm getting ahead of myself here, but just so I don't have to revisit this point, to mention that on page 6 of the transcript, there's a great example where the Spanish-English interpreter mistranslates the name of the month that the other interpreter had said when they were having a scheduling discussion. And then the Spanish-English interpreter explains this interpreter got distracted because her other connection dropped. I think that's just a small illustration of how monitoring that interpreter is taking on a role she wouldn't have had if she was in person. But the issue is that the burden on the quality of interpreting is so pervasive, it means that going into the hearing, there is a substantial risk of error that pervades the trial. It's not like there's just one error, as in the cases, for example, that the state cites, talking about entitled to a fair trial, not a perfect trial. But here we're talking about errors that could pervade the whole trial and that are very hard to document for all the reasons that Mr. Godin just explained. In fact, when there is simultaneous interpreting, even if you had a recording at counsel table, it might be impossible because the simultaneous means they're speaking at the same time as each other, in this case in three different languages or two different languages, but even in a more typical case with just one interpreter, if they're speaking at the same time as someone is speaking in another language, that recording may be very hard to parse, and I think would really require a new technology to figure out how to have a meaningful review of that record.
Spanish interpreter would be in the room, correct?
Your Honor, I don't know the answer to that question. In this case, in the pretrial hearings, I believe at least the transcript in this case showed that that interpreter was also remote. I would think that at the trial, there should be the ability to have someone there in person.
Let's assume that's the case. And I'm sorry to say this to both. Amiki, we'll try to keep your comments to 10 minutes and let what we have. In Minnesota, their guidelines, their policies permit consideration of the length of the proceedings, fiscal feasibility, and urgent circumstances. What is your position on that?
So as I mentioned before, our position is that there should be a per se rule to begin.
So no consideration of fiscal circumstances?
No, and in this case, the judge did consider fiscal feasibility, or at least referred to it in the discussion with counsel after counsel objected to remote interpreting for the trial stage. Considerations, especially, you know, this is a very small number of trials, financial considerations should not be the reason that
we force, we deprive a defendant of their basic right to understand and participate in their trial and consult with counsel. In addition, there's no record, you know, in this particular case, there's really no record of costs. And so I think, I know this is not exactly what you're asking, but I think the question also comes up in terms of are these really costs and has there really been a full investigation of the evidence, weighing of the evidence?
My understanding is your view is cost is not an appropriate consideration. You're not asking us to look at the cost and assess how expensive it is.
Correct.
No matter if it's $10,000 or $110,000, that should be ignored.
Correct, Your Honor. It's because the rights at stake are so substantial here and the deprivation of liberty is so substantial. To just refer back to the question asked about breaks earlier, it's important to understand that the default is that when interpreting is in person, they're already need to, because of the research on fatigue, that happens in person too. And so there already needs to be frequent breaks, about every 30 minutes or 20 to 30 minutes under Nadjet's guidelines. The research on remote interpreting in a conference setting, much with a lower cognitive load than in the setting we're discussing today, shows that fatigue and the increase in error rates for interpreters starts at about 15 to 18 minutes. So the breaks would have to be quite frequent, and breaks are not without costs in a couple of different ways. The breaks typically occur in a trial when one interpreting partner is switching off with another so that the trial doesn't have to pause for those breaks. And that means that they have to transition to a fraction of a second. That is a very complex thing to do remotely. And there's cognitive load associated with frequent transitions as well. If you didn't do that, you would have to take a lot of breaks in the trial. And that would, of course, have implications for the time and the cost and the jury. And also interpreting, also the breaks obviously wouldn't address the other concerns that we've discussed and briefed regarding distractions, technical errors, video processing, et cetera.
Thank you.
I was starting with sort of discussing why this kind of remote interpreting doesn't meet professional standards. I backed my way into that, but.
Counsel, I'm going to invite you to make this last argument nice and short.
Yes, Your Honor.
Because we're beyond 10 minutes now.
So I guess the last thing I would just say is just to flag that that criminal trials are exceptionally complex, that asking interpreters to interpret for proceedings in a situation and under conditions where they cannot interpret fully and accurately, as the research suggests here, puts them in a perilous ethical position under both New Jersey's ethics code of conduct and Nadjet's. And ask the interpreters to take on substantial ethical risks in accepting this sort of assignment. So in closing, the court should clarify that the defendants who speak languages of lesser diffusion, such as Kachikel, deserve the same access to their trials, the same access to their counsel as other defendants, and that remote interpreting is not constitutionally sufficient for criminal trials.
Thank you.